Hello and welcome to Science Off Camera. I'm Dr. Matthew Kersey-Dunn from Teledyne Photometrics, part of the Teledyne Imaging Group. In this podcast, I will be speaking with imaging specialists and industry leaders in scientific imaging from around the world about what they do, the advances they have made, and the cool imaging setups they have in their labs. Before we get started, if you're interested in learning more about scientific cameras and comparing technologies, we're currently holding live, interactive remote learning sessions at our demo centers around the globe. Book a personalized session with one of our application specialists today on our website, photometrics.com. We also have an exciting product, the Kinetics SCMOS, which delivers a frame rate and field of view unmatched by any other SCMOS camera. Book an online demonstration to see how it compares to current camera technologies. In this episode of Science Off Camera, I am talking with Dr. Gilles Van Wellegem, neuroscientist at the Department of Molecular Biology and Genetics at Aarhus University. In this episode, we talk about board games, zebrafish, the enteric nervous system, and the imaging applications used throughout his career. Welcome to the podcast. Could you introduce yourself and tell me about your work and your career path to date?
Yeah, sure. So I just started as an assistant professor at Aarhus University. My name is Dr. Gilles Van Wellegem, and I've been in science since way too long. My research career really with my master thesis in 2005. So that was a while back. And then I've got a bit of an eclectic career. So I did a master thesis in neuroscience, working on mice striatal neurons. And then I did a PhD in parasitology under the supervision of Professor Etienne Pays. And I worked on an African parasite called Trypanosoma brucei, which causes African trypanosomiasis, also called the sleeping sickness. That was really, really super interesting because I got to play with a lot of in vivo work already there. We did some really nice electron microscopy to look at the parasite in the mice. We did some great imaging of immune cells gobbling up those parasites. So that was really interesting. That's when I really started working with imaging. So doing like fluorescence imaging and electron microscopy mostly. And in parallel to my PhD, I was also running a synthetic biology team for the IGEM. So that's the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition that was run, that's still run by the MIT at Boston. And so we got undergrads to play around with those. And then they were able to present their work at the MIT. So that was very exciting for them. And that's where I heard about the optogenetics at this synthetic biology competition. And that got me really hooked. And basically, after my PhD in parasitology, I switched to a postdoc in neuroscience. And that's when I joined Professor Ethan Scott's lab in Australia, in Brisbane, at the University of Queensland. And then I started working with larval zebrafish, which you may not know, but they're completely transparent. So they're amazing to do all kinds of imaging in. We were really lucky because in Ethan's group, there were at first only one optical physicist, so Dr. Ikea Favre-Bull. But later there was another optical physicist that joined the lab, Michael Taylor. They did fantastic work to get us to be able to do all kinds of things in the fish. So we use mostly light sheet microscopy, but they developed optical tweezers to manipulate the otoliths in the ear of the fish. They improved on light sheet microscopy. And then after that postdoc, I managed to get my faculty position here in Aarhus that I started 2 months ago. I'm planning to work on the enteric nervous system in zebrafish and look at the gut-brain axis.
Okay. I had no idea that other organisms had an enteric nervous system.
Oh, yeah. Most animals have that. So it's been studied a lot in Drosophila and in zebrafish. There are a few really good groups that are working on that. I've been looking. There's recently been a paper that just got published with a jellyfish model.
Oh, wow.
But the nervous system is not yet fully, like, it's not super well organized, but they started to look at the contractions and how it's guided by feeding and all of these things. So really, really interesting work.
It's interesting how over many years, neuroscience has kind of spread from the top down in organisms where, like, we're just looking at the brain. The brain's the interesting part, and then the spine, and then the periphery, and now in the gut as well. Like, neuroscience is now covering pretty much everything.
Yeah, no, for sure. And like, as you said, the spinal cord and the periphery has gathered a lot of interest at the moment. Here at Aarhus University, there's another researcher called Dr. Micah Allen that works on brain-body interaction and what is generally called interoception. And how basically that can affect our cognition. So how some of the way that our brain works is linked to the rhythm of our body, like our heartbeat or respiration and all of these things. So it's really interesting to see how for a while neuroscience was really like that brain in a box and we don't care about the rest. To now, actually, the rest of the box is fairly interesting.
Yeah, it's, you know, the box has opened up and everything in the box has changed with the people recognizing astrocytes as more functional and yeah, that kind of thing as well. It's a very exciting time for neuroscience.
Oh yeah, no, exactly. And like the glia also, like, was so to be that kind of boring thing that does not much, but no, there are more and more articles showing how essential it is. There's been a really cool paper, I think it was last year, from Misharen's group in Janelia, where they looked in zebrafish at glia. And what they showed was that it actually encodes the helplessness of the animal. Because when we do our imaging, unless you, well, there is like one microscope that allows you to look at the brain while the fish is swimming. And it's a fantastic piece of engineering done by Dr. Robson and Lee. But otherwise, we have to immobilize the fish. So we take the fish and we put it into an agarose gel so that it doesn't move too much. And then we can image it. The thing is that what we long have observed is that they don't behave as well under the microscope when they're embedded as when they're able to swim. And what Misha's group has shown is that actually the glia encodes the fact that the fish is helpless. And so after a while, the fish just gives up and doesn't act anymore.
Wow. That's such a fascinating metric that you can quantify.
Yeah, no, that was really, really amazing work. Like, we, with the advent of optogenetics and those calcium indicator and all the beautiful advances in microscopy, it's really a lot of people are able to look everywhere in much more details and finding all sorts of cool stuff. Mm.
What has it been like performing this kind of research across so many different locations in the world? Because there's lots of different research cultures and availability of funding and that kind of thing.
There's always a bit of culture shock, especially in terms of science, like the way that funders and universities rank your work or look at research to gauge the quality changes dramatically. It can go from, you know, it's fine if you publish one top tier journal paper every few years, that's perfectly fine, to you need to publish 3 or 4 articles per year to be considered productive. So you kind of have to learn what works in each country. And yeah, there are some countries where it's getting more complicated or not. Like Australia at the moment, a lot of scientists are very, very upset with the funding rates and the way that it's handled is not great, especially for early and mid-career researchers. So there's been a lot of pushback and hope that, you know, a new government may change things.
And are you looking forward to getting to know a new research culture now that you've recently moved?
Yes. I mean, Denmark is still Europe where, you know, I did my PhD in Belgium, so it's somewhat similar, but they have a very interesting funding landscape where it's a lot of actually private industries. So they have tax breaks for industries where basically they can set up foundations that then fund science. And so here, you know, instead of applying to the NIH or to like the government agency, still one, but it's smaller. You're going to apply to Carlsberg for funding for your research, or to Willem, the ones that make those Velux windows. These are the kind of foundations that exist and that fund science. So it's fairly interesting to see the shift.
Wow, I'm imagining a Carlsberg branded microscope in the lab.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what it is, you know. It's they just recently announced the people that were funded, and in our department there are a few people that got big grants to establish to continue some projects. Mm. And one of my colleague received money to buy a confocal microscope. So yeah, you could have a Carlsberg sticker on your confocal microscope.
Wow. So what has your experience of different imaging techniques been across your career? Because you've moved through a variety of different applications, and you mentioned different sample mounting methods. What kind of techniques have you experienced?
It's been literally a bit of everything. So I've done everything from immunofluorescence, you know, fixing the animals, embedding them, treating with antibodies. As I mentioned, I did some electron microscopy, and there we had to learn how to perfuse the whole animal with PFA before we would start to like dissect the organs and then cut them into, so that we could then image them in scanning electron microscopy. So luckily, every time that I started to learn a new technique, we had fantastic technicians that knew a lot about the techniques that could really help me out. Interesting challenge to learn all of these techniques. So the one thing that I have yet to play with and that I'm really excited about is the whole expansion microscopy and clarification, clearing methods, to really go into more details into the different mechanism that happens into the cell. So that's not something that I've played with very much, but yeah, it's been a bit all over the place.
I feel like clearing and expansion lends itself particularly well to neuroscience, because you've got such dense structures that are very hard to visualize otherwise.
Yes, definitely. For zebrafish, I think, because it's transparent, you don't always need the clearing, but it does help a lot. But the expansion microscopy can give you amazing results. There was just a preprint where they expanded the whole larvae and did just, you know, imaging over, I don't know how long it took them, but yeah, like it's an amazing resource that we now have. Especially in zebrafish, the brain is super densely packed. And so if you want to start tracing things, at the moment, the best method is like you do a variegated expression. So you've got the expression of your fluorophore in only a few cells, and you hope that it matches what you're interested in. There is also the photoactivatable GFP that gives you a bit more power in really targeting specific things. But yeah, with expansion microscopy, it gives a lot more options. And also you can use multiple colors, and like it's very, very... like it's definitely something that I'm planning to learn at some point.
It's definitely there's quite a movement towards more physiological imaging, where you really want to be able to image a zebrafish from larva all the way through to death, just with as little perturbation as possible. But this isn't always possible, and it's an enormous challenge, especially when you have very intense light sources and you need to immobilize the sample and that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. And like light sheet microscopy is the thing that most people use in zebrafish. That's what I'm planning to build here in Aarhus, and that's proven to be fantastic. And like I keep an eye on all the newest developments with adaptive optics and, you know, beam shaping methods to try to improve the light sheet itself. So it's very exciting to see what's happening. As a biologist, it's sometimes slightly out of my comfort zone, but you know, that's why you collaborate with optical physicists, optical engineers.
Where do you think the field of imaging in these kind of neuroscientific methods is going to go? Do you think people are going to look towards more functional imaging, or is it just going to get larger and more high resolution? What do you think you would like to see happen?
Personally, I would love to be able to have like massive field of view where you could image across the entire animal, you know, both the brain and the gut at the same time, to see what's happening in the neurons. So some kind of the mesoscope for zebrafish where you can image the whole larvae. And especially in neuroscience, with all the new indicators that are being developed, having something that's really fast so that you can start. Because the big problem at the moment with calcium imaging and with fluorescence imaging is the speed, really. Mm. Like, you cannot easily see the spikes as you do in electrophysiology. There are some voltage sensors that are coming up, but usually the field of view becomes very small because you need like 1,000 images per second to be able to resolve spikes. it's going to be interesting to see like what the trade-off people will be willing to do in the future. And I think at the moment, the big challenge for a lot of people is really on the data side, like managing those vast amounts of data, really, really difficult. Like the people that are doing lattice light chain microscopy, when they generate terabytes of data, then what do you do with it, right? That's one of the big issues at the moment. But otherwise, in terms of imaging, I'm really hoping to see like adaptive optics becoming more available to the public, to like people like me that kind of know a little bit about optics, but I'm not going to start building using deformable mirrors to change the wavefront of my thing. Like I know what it means, but I have no idea how to do it myself.
I feel like there's a biologist are asked to learn about, you know, it'd be good if you knew a lot about coding for these kind of, you know, making your own Python scripts. And then it'd also be good if you know everything about optics and microscopy so you can build your own systems. And then also everything about biology and neuroscience and whatever else you can get, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's why all of these projects are so interdisciplinary. And that's why, like, when we were working with optical physicists, that was really super useful to us because they obviously have completely different set of expertise. And so being able to work together to kind of find what's actually useful and what makes sense is great. And sometimes it's small things that, you know, Michael Taylor came up with using a line diffuser to expand the light sheet in X and Y to remove shadowing. And that was like a very cheap modification to a light sheet microscope that we did not think about at all. Definitely more interdisciplinary work is needed in neuroscience, like a mixture of data scientists and optical engineers and physicists, and the neuroscientist is the future.
Are you building yourself a team in your new location? Are you going to include all these different disciplines?
Eventually, yes. That's the hope. So I've reached out to the physicists here to see what could work. I've reached out to some companies in Denmark that build lasers. And so we have a few like ideas of things that could be interdisciplinary work. And I'm keeping in touch with my colleagues in Australia and New Zealand that are optical physicists. So that's the goal, to have a team that's interdisciplinary. So I'm recruiting at the moment. I already have a PhD student lined up, and I'm recruiting a postdoc, so I'll see who applies. But yeah, I'm hoping to have a mix in my team in the future.
It's a nice idea as well that even though you've moved across many far-reaching countries because of the advance of technology and this kind of communication, you've not lost the ability to still collaborate with these people as well.
If there's one thing that's been positive with COVID, it's how Zoom and Teams and all of these, you know, remote working technologies have really improved and shown to allow good collaborations. Even online conferences are getting really nice with like fun ways to still interact socially. I don't think it will replace in-person conferences because we're still social animals, but it's been great to be able to have those online conferences, meetings with people.
I've been to a few of these hybrid conferences that have been almost like someone made a video game, in that you make an avatar and you walk around this virtual space, and when you get close to someone, it opens up a sort of a Zoom chat with them. That was really bizarre.
Yeah, I've seen that on Twitter, but I have not yet experienced it. I don't know how well it works.
Thing is, if there's someone you want to talk to, you end up with people just hugging the walls to get around without getting too close to anybody.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, that would be very, very weird and somewhat creepy to see someone like hug the wall next to you.
So what kind of things do you do outside of the lab?
I'm definitely a geek, so we do a lot of board games and video games, both with my wife and my daughter, and we have a couple of friends here that are also into those things. So lots and lots of board games. That's one of my favorite things. Still exploring Aarhus and Denmark. So we're going out to like see the different natural parks and visit the museums and this kind of thing. So it's been very interesting to move around and discover all of these new countries. While we were in Australia, obviously Denmark is not as suited, but we were, so we also do scuba diving, and my daughter just got her scuba diver certification, so we're looking forward to doing more of that.
Oh, fantastic. So there's a lot of focus on fish. You have fish for research, and then you can scuba dive and see the beautiful reefs and the fish there as well.
Yes, yes, that came later in my life, but yes, no, I'm more definitely more interested in fish than when I started.
This is probably going to be a very tough question, but could you tell me your top five board games?
My top five board games? Oh.
Because I'm also very into board games myself.
I think at the moment one of my top five, but it's still on the container from Australia, is Split Island, which is a great cooperative board game. With my daughter, we are also playing some dungeon crawlers, so she really likes those. So. I think Star Wars Imperial Assault is really one of my favorites. We discovered Root recently, which is just great.
Yeah.
We've played that with a friend. Eclipse is definitely in my top four. One of the ones that we really enjoy is Tapestry, which is a kind of a civilization kind of game, but a bit shorter. That's really fun. Yeah, restricting it to five is hard because I also love worker placement games. So.
Yeah, I just got Viticulture.
Oh, nice.
That's a good, and we have Stone Age, and they're very good worker placement games. And I've played Everdell at cafes, but that's very much worker placement-y. And I thought Root was kind of similar because they both have a woodland creature aesthetic, but it turns out Root is a lot more competitive.
Oh, yeah, it's a brutal war game. Like, where I was the same, like, we have Everdell. Well, I'm waiting on the new big box Kickstarter thing. Mm. But, yeah, when the first time we played Root with a friend, he warned us, yeah, so don't be fooled by the, like, aesthetic. It's not a nice, cozy game.
I got Wingspan and Viticulture because the aesthetic seems very like, oh, this one's about birds, this one's about wine. But it's still like fairly, like this is very engine building and this is very important that you build these things in the right ages and so on.
Yeah, one we got for the aesthetics, which is really fun and my daughter loves it, is Calico, where you've got to build a quilt to attract cats on.
Yeah.
And so that's a very, very nice game. That's a fairly chill, still competitive, but very, very nice.
I have a slightly opposite experience where we got a game for the mechanics, but the appearance of the game is really not that great. And that's Terraforming Mars. Where, you know, it's very, very popular. And you look at the board and you think, was this made by a company or did someone like sketch this?
Yeah, very much so. The Ares Expedition is slightly better, but yes, the original Terraforming Mars, the art is definitely not the greatest.
It's been a good time for board games because, you know, when we were in lockdown, me and my wife played them quite a lot. And then we also discovered a Tabletop Simulator.
Yes.
Where we, you know, and then you play board games of people that you can't get access to. And that's really nice as well. And some games work better in that format.
Yeah, yeah, we are playing a lot of Board Game Arena, which is a website-based kind of like tabletop simulator, and we're still playing with our friends in Australia. So we do morning for us, evening for them kind of games, which works quite well. Yeah.
So, is there anything in particular that you would like to discuss given this platform?
Well, since you're working for, you know, a company that's involved in those microscopes, where do you see the like innovations coming in the near future for users like me?
I guess I see it coming from two main areas. One is largely similar to what you said, where people want things to be bigger field of view and they're going to want them to be higher speed so you can catch the voltage and other dynamic samples that they couldn't really capture before. But you need them both at the same time. You want it to be big and you want it to be fast. But you can't be fast without being highly sensitive because you're coming in with like 1 millisecond or less exposure time.
Yeah.
So, okay, it needs to be highly sensitive and very fast and with a large field of view. And then you also want a high resolution on top of that. And so that's basically every single camera spec there is. And they're all going to slowly go up at different speeds over time. So we have the kinetics, and you can do 500 frames a second across the full field. And we've had some people do voltage imaging with that. At some point, your bottleneck is the computer or the camera or the microscope. And as soon as you improve one of them, like, oh, now the camera can go much bigger, but my microscope can't. Okay, we got a new microscope. Ah, oh, but my computer is very slow, so now we can't run the camera. And so now, you know, it every single part of the imaging industry needs to go up at roughly the same rate, or people need to look at each one of these factors and then be able to have an imaging system that isn't bottlenecked by itself. And then the other aspect is within the computer and the camera is the software, namely the machine learning and the algorithms and the sort of data aspect of it. Because you can brute force a lot of these things. You can get the system that's significantly more powerful and bigger and faster. But you can also get smart algorithms that look, oh, I only actually need this tiny region of interest of this massive camera. We're just going to take that and save that. And so there's a lot of different free open source algorithms on ImageJ. You know, people share a lot of their work on GitHub. There's all sort of Python scripts and MATLAB, and people are writing lots of scripts, and it's kind of open science. It's great. But you know, there's the smart aspect of it, which you can either bake into the camera or you can have it running off of the computer. But a lot of that depends on how keen people are on their raw data, in that most of the scientists I've met are hoarders, in that you can go into the minus 80 fridge and you can go back about 15 years through the samples towards the back of the fridge. People don't really throw stuff away.
Definitely.
The same is true of the data, in that you can say we can produce much smaller files and it's much easier for your storage and analysis, but you also want to keep the raw data as well. So there'll definitely be advancements in all of those areas, getting the hardware up to date, making sure all the hardware plays nicely with each other and nothing is limiting it too much, and then making sure the software you get does what you need it to do and you still get the data you want out of it.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it's the temptation to keep all of the raw data is there, even though you don't really need it, but still, you know, it's like I can also understand the not trusting black boxes that do magic stuff to your data, because that's one of the drawback of some of these softwares is that, you know, if there is one small bug, then you're doomed. There was a, I think there was something with the in the fMRI field where one of the big thing that was used, they discovered a bug, and that was not ideal. But yeah, otherwise the open source, I think, is definitely like it's been amazing. Like when you see the advance in the past, even 5 years, like with NAPARI appearing out of nowhere and being now supported by the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and you've got so many people doing amazing plugins for it. It's been really, really great for us biologists to be able to, you know, just take something that that people have built and implement it. And usually, especially in the open source world, people are very, very happy to help you out, and that's fantastic.
Thanks again to my guest. If you like this podcast, please follow Photometrics on social media for more episodes, and check out photometrics.com for the latest in scientific camera technology for life sciences, such as the Kinetics SCMOS camera. We also host episodes that focus more on physical science applications, such as near-infrared, X-ray imaging, and spectroscopy, partnering with Teledyne Princeton Instruments. Follow them on social media to see when the next episode is released. See you next time, and stay safe.